MCC, but she is not participating in this case. To my immediate left is Justice William Babbage. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, and I'm the Chief Justice. My immediate right is Justice Donald Steinman. And to his right, Justice John Wilcox, and on the far right, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. As I explained this morning, when La Crosse was on the frontier of not only the state, but of the nation, there was a judge in this county called Robert Looney. And he was an excellent judge who kept order in his court. And one day, Charles Stevens and Joseph French, both lawyers in La Crosse, were arguing his case. And they were able, but they had adopted the ways, the rough ways of the frontier lawyers and the frontier courts. And so they were trying this case before the judge, and they became more and more abusive, and the judge demanded order. And finally the judge laid down his pen, took off his coat, and he threw the lawyers out. And he put back his coat, took back his pen, and he quietly announced that he would whip any lawyer if he had to keep order in the court. So Justice Babbage is in charge of this session. Counsel beware. All right. Now, counsel, we're now going to call 92-2187, Nierengarten versus Lutheran Social Services of Wisconsin. Mr. Hayes, I show you, is arguing for 25 minutes with a 5-minute rebuttal. And I show for Lutheran Social Services, Mr. Brady for 15 minutes, Mr. Black for 10, and a rebuttal by Mr. Black, according to my notes. Correct? Okay, you may proceed. Pardon me? Okay. All right, are we ready to proceed? All right. Mr. Hayes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm sure you'll have no need for just establishment services today. Could you put up the chair, please? I'd like to introduce Susan Lovern, who is working on this case with me, and also from Lutheran Social Services, Carol Hakala, Sherry Levin, and Christy LaFleur, who we're seated right behind me. Now, why is Lutheran Social Services in this courtroom here today? In 1989, this court decided Miracle versus Children's Service Society, which made it clear that there was a cause of action for negligent misrepresentation in the adoption context. What did Miracle say regarding social service agencies and their behavior? I'm quoting, "To avoid liability, agencies must simply refrain from making affirmative misrepresentations about a child's health. We do not hold that agencies have any duty to disclose health information." Other cases from around the country, including the Mallett case in Rhode Island and the Caritas case in Minnesota, both of which have been cited, confirmed that an agency can avoid liability by giving no information at all to the couple about the child's health. Now, why are we here? Because Lutheran Social Services believes that it should share information. Consequently, it gave out every piece of information that it had concerning this adoptee to the adopted couple, who are the plaintiffs in this case. Thus, before the placement was made, the plaintiffs had made all written information which LSS, that's Lutheran Social Services, had received from Eastern Child Welfare Society in South Korea. That is an uncontested fact in this case. Had Lutheran Social Services given out no information at all about the family or the health of the child, negligent misrepresentation wouldn't lie under Miracle. We agree that once information was furnished to the plaintiffs, LSS did assume a duty of disclosure, that it must not, then, affirmatively misrepresent the child's health. Up to the time of placement, then, the adopting couple had everything LSS had, the pre-flight report, a social history, a medical report, and now I'd like to move to take a look at the time from placement to finalization of adoption. And later I'm going to try and draw a distinction between the placement date and the time of adoption date, because I think that's significant.
Counselor, did I understand you to state that once you give information, then you acknowledge that you have a duty to make sure that you don't misrepresent that information?
That's right.
Is that what your position is?
Right. If we assume a duty to disclose, mm-hmm. which we did in this case by giving out information, we should not misrepresent that information.
Well,
if that's consistent. Excuse me.
Do you consider omission a representation or misrepresentation?
Yes.
So we agree that what you did say, at least at that time, was correct. That's your position, right?
Right.
What about omission?
An omission prior to placement, I think, could be actionable, as it has been actionable in other states around the country. And that's why I draw the distinction about before placement. Let's assume, for example, that the agency knew that the father and the mother had engaged in an incestuous relationship. That's the Caritas case out of Minnesota. If they had engaged in an incestuous relationship, that's negative information that should have been given, we think, to the couple at some point, especially if they have already engaged in this duty to disclose and have given out information. They can't misrepresent what they have. Or Gibbs v. Ernst would be another good example. That's a Pennsylvania case. In that case, they misrepresented pretty substantially the information they had in their file at the time. This is a child they represented as having been in a foster placement once, one foster home, when in fact the child was in 10 foster homes. So could there be negligent misrepresentation by omission? I believe there could, but let's confine it now to this time before the placement.
Let me ask you, why should we confine it to that period of time? Don't you think it's very significant, the period after placement and before adoption, where the prospective adoptive parents are considering whether or not to finalize an adoption?
I don't mean to minimize the fact that that time period isn't important. It is important. But there's a completely different set of circumstances that takes over at the time of placement. Then who is the family, who is the party, who is the individual that has the best opportunity to gauge the health of the child? Once the placement has occurred, and in this case, if you look at my chart, that placement took place on April 24th of 1987. Once that placement itself took place, the Nierengartens were in total control of the child.
Oh, in this particular situation, it's my understanding that the Court of Appeals zeroed in on that period after placement and before finalization, and they being the judges on the Court of Appeals, found it was significant that allegedly your clients were indicating that this child was going through normal adjustment behavior when, after the fact now, the information seems very much to the contrary. Why then are we zeroing in on the time before placement? I'm not understanding why.
Let me finish my comment on
that.
After the placement is made, information about the child is substantially in the control of the adopting couple. They see the child 24 hours a day. Okay, it isn't as though the agency came into information during that time period or prior to the adoption that was any different than what they had prior to placement, because they did not. But once the placement is made, the health information about the child is primarily under the control of the adopting couple. The agency picks up periodic monthly written reports, and those are our record here, about the child, and also would pick up any phone calls, and there were some here, about the child. But they aren't diagnosing the child at that point. The couple is in the best position to determine the health of the child and determine whether an adoption should take place.
Because under the omission clause, the omission of the notes that came from the orphanage in 94, what duty, if any, did Lutheran Social Services have to procure those notes prior to that time? In other words, they existed. Is that, you're saying that no, because they didn't come to our attention, we have no duty, and we had none, and we were not aware of it. Does that fall within their ordinary course of operation to ascertain whether there are notes?
No. There is no law here that says that the agency had a duty to investigate or discover or go out and seek those notes. And it wasn't imposed in this case either by the contract which was entered into between the Nierengartens and the agency.
Why not? You started your argument with a concession such as it is. Once we assume a duty to disclose, you say, then we cannot misrepresent. Why can't the Nierengartens take a look at that agreement and say, you assumed a duty. You assumed a duty to make, quoting from the agreement, make every effort to get as much information as possible. That's the duty that you assume, they argue. Once you assume that duty, obviously those notes were easy for you to obtain. No big surprise that they have notes that they wasn't. Once you assume that duty, why can't you be held to that duty?
I think what's done here is they're suggesting that the contract creates this duty. There needs to be an independent duty that's been created by tort, which there is not in this case. And because there isn't, you can't now impose this duty by contract, and there's case law to
support that. Cite that. Well, what about a breach of the contract?
That wasn't alleged. It wasn't pled in this case.
Would it be timely here? What's the statute of limitations?
I believe the statute of limitations is 6 years on a breach of contract.
That's right.
Thus, it would be my position, Your Honor, that is not a relevant subject for discussion at this point. If I can go back to the argument I was getting to on the statute of limitations, if you'll see the chart here, what I've attempted to do is draw out a comparison between the Miracle case and the Nierengarten case. Now, in Miracle, on October 18 of 1979, that was the date the placement was made. But prior to that date, prior to placement, the caseworker is alleged to have said that this child will have no greater risk of Huntington's disease than a child in the general population would. The Miracles went ahead and adopted on November 12 of 1990. It was a finalization. 1980. February 8 of 1981, the parents are watching television, and they become aware of the fact that the Huntington's disease was a possibility for the child, and it was to a greater degree of risk than the general a child in the general population. So at that point,
inherited disease,
right?
Maybe.
At that point, it is clear that there has been some misrepresentation, but it isn't clear that a cause of action has accrued. Because the child is not diagnosed with Huntington's disease until 1984. Once the diagnosis is made, it is clear that there are future expenses and there is a right to sue. There are actionable damages, so the statute of limitations begins to run on September 27 of 1984. The Miracles then filed their lawsuit on a timely basis. Now let's take a look at this case and see what happened. April 24, the date of the placement, the representations were made, if you accept the plaintiff's representations as true, that the child was healthy. Between placement and the adoption finalization, Mrs. Nierengarten identified lots of problems with the child, including extreme temper tantrums, hyperactivity, biting the child bit a sibling. Quite a few problems were identified. The adoption was then finalized. Now, nothing else happened legally that is significant until March of 1990. At that point, the Nierengartens take the child to Dr. Hughes, where he is diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. At that stage, medical treatment begins. At that stage, prescriptions are being paid for. At that stage, there's also a referral to Dr. Hammond for family counseling. So you have expenses beginning. There's been an injury, and it's clear that there is a cause of action now against Lutheran Social Services. So at that point, the statute of limitations begins.
I'm sorry, how many, does the record show what the expenses are?
No, there's no dollar amount shown there. And that's one of the concerns I have about the Court of Appeals decision here, because it seems to me that they're creating a test on the subject of extraordinary damages based on quantum. How much And it's my position that if you spend 1 cent for expenses, and that would be, and those expenses are extraordinary expenses, that shows that the cause of action has accrued.
Mr.
Hayes, how would you measure extraordinary expenses other than to look at the raw dollar amount? What suggestion do you have in that regard?
Well, I think that you, the Supreme Court, has given us guidance in that regard in two cases. Certainly in the Miracle case, you have given us guidance. You're talking about expenses that are unexpected expenses. And these certainly were unexpected expenses from the standpoint of the Nierengartens. And the Wright case, which was cited in the Miracle case, also would indicate that ordinary expenses, as opposed to extraordinary expenses, would be expenses for food, for clothing, and for education.
Now, you have a child, and the child is very susceptible to strep. In fact, could be a carrier. And so anytime there's strep, the kid may show it or not show it. It has to be tested because you've got a real problem. So you got to run them into the hospital. You've got to get a test. You then have to worry about how the test comes out. Then you got a whole load of penicillin. There's a whole routine you go through.
We would say that that's an extraordinary expense that gives them a right to start the lawsuit. What it does not do is what a jury would later do, and that is determine whether strep is something that they're going to award damages for. And my speculation on that would be that they probably wouldn't award damages for strep because that is something that is to be expected.
Well, where do you draw the line between ordinary and extraordinary?
Okay. I draw it using the term unexpected, for example, as I mentioned before. And let me throw another term in which I think would be appropriate.
Sure, some kids get given, some kids don't.
Yeah. But you have to take a look at the misrepresentation and whether there was a misrepresentation here. If the agency said, this child will never get measles, now that may seem ridiculous, but if that's what they said and the child then got measles, that would at least give them the right to bring their lawsuit. At that point, they can sue. I'm not dealing with the subject of whether they can recover at that point. I'm dealing with the subject of whether they can sue at that point. They have the right to sue. Now, the case later, they bring their lawsuit, and then later a decision is going to be made as to whether they're entitled to recover for measles, for strep throat, for allergies, as our opponents alleged.
Well, it seems to me that you've drawn that line of extraordinary really tightly to start that statute of limitations. I was going to take you from the strep throat to a congenital heart disease, which had the child been carefully examined by physicians, would have been picked up. So now the family is dealing with strep throat, but what you really have is debilitating heart disease. Which results in the absolute worst case scenario of death.
Are you linking the strep throat
yes.
with heart disease?
Mm-hmm. Okay. And strep throat is linked with heart disease.
Well, I didn't know that.
Okay.
In that case, you'd be taking a look at the Pritzlaff case, which was decided by this court. And even though the damages may be small at one point and they expand into some huge, huge amount, that doesn't make any difference. And that's really what we claim our opponents are trying to argue here. Because later, right below statute of limitations, I didn't put it on there, in 1994 they diagnosed bipolar disorder, which is a bigger disease, if you want to call it that. But our point is, it doesn't matter. Because they had the right to sue early on. The fact that they can't specifically identify all of the damages they're going to get doesn't matter.
If they incur the expense of having to go out and buy a bottle of aspirin that they otherwise wouldn't have, doesn't that strike you as fairly absurd that starts a statute of limitations? That one
no.
speck of sand on a beach creates
no.
what?
Now, the test is not a quantum test. This court has never said that is a quantum test. The only time I'd seen that test used is the Court of Appeals decision in this case. It is not a quantum.
Mr. Haynes, let me follow up with Justice Savage's question for a minute. It's my understanding that there are millions, literally millions of children in this country that take Ritalin and other prescriptions for ADHD on a daily basis. Where do we cross the line from ordinary to extraordinary, not focusing on dollar amount now, focusing on how many people have this type of problem?
I don't think you make that analysis. And that's one of the issues that troubles me about the way this case has proceeded up to this point. I think it's important that you, the court, take a look at the causes of action that were pleaded initially, because under the Grams case, you must make a decision as to whether a claim was stated initially.
What do you think about a jury making a determination on a special verdict as to whether or not what was experienced here was extraordinary expense, rather than have this court make that determination?
You could do that. I don't think that's a proper way to do it, and you don't need to do it in this case.
How can we do that? Because the extraordinary expense, when that's incurred, that's the touchstone of when a cause of action accrues, and you're saying you'd let the jury determine as a matter of law when a cause of action accrues?
I don't think that's right. I think that you're correct.
I think
that you're correct, and the cause of action starts when there are extraordinary damages, and that is something that you have defined already for us. You don't need to do anything further. I would like you to include perhaps the term unusual in there, as the Chicago case we cited did.
Well, let's assume that you're drafting our opinion for us in this particular case. How would you draft it so that we could give to the trial court of this state a very good, clear definition of extraordinary expense?
Okay. I think that you've done that already in the Miracle case, because I think that you talked about unexpected expenses. You've done that with the Wright case when you said ordinary expenses are going to be things that you'd expect to pay in the raising of a child, things like food, clothing, educational type expense. So you have those components there. I thought it was clear that that was the definition. I was shocked by the decision of the Court of Appeal, because I think they are plainly incorrect based on the instruction that they have gotten from this court on that subject. Now, if you include the word unusual, that helps a little bit. It elaborates a bit on unexpected, but that is a definition that was used by the court in the Illinois case, which we cited in the letter that we sent to you. Let me refer to one other point, Justice Crooks, that you made earlier. You talked about millions and millions of kids having ADHD. I don't think that's particularly relevant for the purposes of our case, because I don't think we're talking about normal. By the way, normal was raised for the first time in the reply brief of our opponents in the Court of Appeals, so we've never had a chance to address that argument. We're concerned that the Court of Appeals then latched onto that and took it the next step and included it in its decision. But back to ADHD, if you take a look at DSM-4, DSM-4 has been cited with approval by this court previously. It has been cited by Dr. Hammond, and it was cited by the University of Minnesota medical material that you've received. It shows that only 3 to 5% of school-aged children are affected by ADHD. I don't think that's a good test to use, but frankly, 3 to 5% doesn't strike me as being a normal disease, even if you would make that argument. Now, so our basic position is that the statute of limitations expired clearly 3590. If I can speak briefly about the other subjects, going to the subject of negligent misrepresentation, it's an undisputed fact that LSS didn't make any false statements before this child was placed with the plaintiffs. They had virtually total control of the child and the health information at that point. Now, it's clear that the plaintiff's complaint then was hyperactive, threw these extreme tantrums, bit one of the siblings, didn't sleep well, quit his bed. They claim that LSS said this was normal adjustment, and indeed, for purposes of this, you must accept that as being true. That is one of the rules of summary judgment procedure. So, accept that those statements were made. Now, if you examine the complaint, and if you go back to the Grams case, the first element you have to take a look at is whether or not claim has been stated. Our position is no claim was stated with respect to that claim. If you examine the complaint, it would indicate that negligent misrepresentation, at least that claim advanced by the plaintiffs initially and argued at the trial court, had to do with whether the agency misrepresented the availability of adoption assistance. That's the claim that was made.
I'm glad that you point that out. What is your understanding of the asserted misrepresentation? We have the first cause of action, which is negligent placement. We have the second cause of action, which is failure to provide notes with the proximate cause of the injury. We have the third cause of action, which is we were not told about the assistance available. Mm-hmm. The Court of Appeals doesn't look at either of those and says the negligent misrepresentation is that they said this was normal adjustment. What is the representation that allegedly is misrepresented in this case?
That's a good question. And one of the things that's been troubling to me is when a case starts in the trial court, there are certain issues that are set forth in the pleadings, and then you submit briefs with your motion to dismiss or in opposition to the motion to dismiss. It sets forth what I think should be the issues that you follow all the way up to the Supreme Court. And let me characterize it as being a highway with three lanes in it. And the case in each cause of action should stay in its own lane all the way up to the Supreme Court. This did not happen in this case with the negligent misrepresentation claim, because what happened was, in that claim, in the Court of Appeals, and it started with the reply brief where they started talking about normalcy, they went out of their lane. And now you're getting the case with not the issues that were raised in the trial court, or the defined claim raised in the trial court, but a new claim of negligent misrepresentation. So I'm pleased you pointed that out. I think that's a problem that my opponents have in this case. I think the cause of action changed on the way up. And I think the Court of Appeals contributed to that change, not only by misapplying the definition of extraordinary, but by taking a look at normal, by taking a look at how much as a question, and then taking a look at this negligent misrepresentation claim and recasting it. We answered initially with the adoption assistance argument, and it was plain that their claim was legally not justified at that point.
Thank you, Mr. Hayes.
Thank you.
Time is up. We have several minutes for rebuttal. We will hear from Charles Brady. Brady?
Thank you, Chief Justice. Honorable members of the court, I'm appearing, Attorney Charles Brady, appearing of counsel to Davidson and Black. Edward Black is here with me today. Our clients from Nierengarten are also here today, John and Betty Nierengarten, and law clerk Alan Morgan. Picking up right where Mr. Hayes left off, I think the problem in the development of this is that we have, from the beginning, from pleading onward, cast this case in terms of general negligence law, and this three-lane highway that Mr. Hayes is talking about. We, I think, did a proper notice pleading, and we threw in the things that we thought could be proven and to establish a claim. And all of them, whether negligent misrepresentation, negligent placement, or just plain negligence of failing to disclose, are grounded in negligence, and they're grounded in the duties in the same way that this court has looked at duties in every other negligence case. In other words, was there an action or an inaction under circumstances where it was reasonably foreseeable that harm could be done? And we think clearly that in adoption circumstance, and clearly consistently with Miracle, that was the case here. I mean, it can, we don't think it can be doubted that the Miracle, that the Nierengartens, if you tell them you're raising a normal child during a period of placement and something can be done about it, and in fact there's things that are not revealed, that obviously there's a likelihood of harm could be done, the adoption could be continued, additional costs could be incurred. Likewise...
Counsel, I want to pick up that same question that I just asked your opposing counsel. The Court of Appeals said, essentially, that the negligent misrepresentation was the representation that this was normal adjustment. Is that what you believe the... Is that the representation that you are asserting was misrepresented in this case? What is the misrepresentation?
That certainly is one aspect of the negligence, to say that to represent that you are raising a child, that the behavior characteristics that were reported back to the...
Which one are you asserting? What was misrepresented in this case?
Well, in our pleading, we said that the representation was we'd ask for a healthy child, and I mean, they all still exist. I mean, we'd ask for a healthy child and did not get a healthy child. The misrepresentation in the context was when we inquired and
what cause of action did you state that?
What cause?
You have three causes of action, right, in your complaint?
Right.
Which? The first one was negligence and placement. I assume that that's a misrepresentation cause of action?
Well, I think that technically no at the time that it was pleaded. And
Court of Appeals treats it differently, right?
That correct.
Court of Appeals does not treat that as a misrepresentation cause of action.
I believe that's correct.
What cause of action is your misrepresentation cause of action or causes of action?
Well, I think that it is generally a negligent misrepresentation cause of action. I guess I'm not... I'm referring to specifically pleaded causes as opposed to what was developed in the summary judgment motion.
As I look at the complaints, there are three causes of action. The first one is negligence in placement. The way the Court of Appeals treated that, it treated it as though that is not a misrepresentation action, but a negligence in placement. The Court of Appeals focused on the misrepresentation that this was a normal adjustment. What misrepresentation and in what cause of action are you asserting?
Well, in our third cause of action, we allege that the adoptee was a healthy child and not eligible for adoption assistance.
You said that the child was healthy and not eligible for the assistance program, and that the reason that the assistance was not applied for was because of the representation that the child was healthy and not eligible.
Right, but as it developed, of course, I mean, we're not, I guess I'm somewhat back when we wanted to have a trial and develop all the issues in this case, and we would have developed issues, and we would have shown that all the other consequences were things that could have been done had they been properly informed, or at least had not have been misled, and kind of had our fears about the child allayed. And so I think that's the context, and again, I think back, I think we're talking negligence, negligence, negligence. I think that there are all circumstances where someone should have done something and didn't, and then the rest of it, I think...
The reason I pursue it is because you're talking about negligence misrepresentation, and there are elements to the representation. That the representation was false. It was known to be false. And so in order to do the analysis of the elements, we have to know which misrepresentation you're pursuing.
I think in the context of a misrepresentation claim, when you make any sort of affirmative representation about normalcy, the misrepresentation is it belies everything else that's not normal. And I think that that's the essence of it. And as the Court of Appeals found, the inference from the doctor's affidavit was that they knew or could have known at the time, which kind of flies into our disclosure cause of action, but at the time the child wasn't normal. It could have been known at the time the child wasn't normal had they not been misled.
Mr. Brady, if we might, let's talk for a couple minutes about the statute of limitations.
Sure.
Why shouldn't it start on the 5th of March of 1990 when your clients learned that the child had ADHD? My understanding that after that they started to have expenses for Ritalin and then for a series of other prescription drugs. It's also my understanding that they had to go into counseling. They were in a family counseling program. Why are those not extraordinary expenses, which would cause the statute to kick in and start?
One factual reference first. The record reveals in the, and if you look at the appendix in the appellant's response, I believe, these people had two other children that had the diagnosis of ADHD. So you don't have to go to the broad norms of society. You can find the norms within this family. And obviously these people, as a factual matter, were willing to bear the situation with ADHD. Now, we don't know now, as a factual matter, that what some of those behaviors, which again is in the record, were attributed to ADHD at the time, were actually this bipolar disorder, because they were much worse in the record than the ADHD problem.
So, counsel, I want to take Justice Crook's question. I want to put it in miracle. Although Justice Callow used the word exceptional, he immediately qualified that by saying, he could have put the letters IE. He says, it is only the extraordinary expenses, comma, the unexpected expenses resulting from Aaron's special needs.
I read an ID in that. Extraordinary, in other words, unexpected. And at least that's where I am in my thinking right now. But the statute might well begin when unexpected expenses occur. Now, were these unexpected or expected?
I guess, again, unexpected from the standpoint of anybody in society, from the Nierengarten standpoint. You know, I think the question here, and there is a standard, another alternate standard of miracle at 149 with second 29, where it's referring to Huntington's disease, is that Aaron would need extensive future medical care. Now, I think that's the standard. Admittedly, none of these are going to be entirely satisfactory because, you know, it's kind of like the famous definition of obscenity. You can't really say what it is, but you know it when you see it.
Well, we've got to, you know, our problem is we're going to have to draft something that so people don't have to guess, at least can make reasonable guesses, and then like the other cases that will further refine it. But in that paragraph that I quoted from, they were talking about ordinary expenses, and then he flipped on to the unexpected expenses. It seems to me that the court did draw a line there. Extraordinary expenses are defined as those that are not ordinarily expected, or extraordinary expenses are unexpected expenses. Unexpected in the sense that you normally would not expect a child to incur these types of expenses. Now, it seems to me that it can be argued by LSS that ADHD and the expenses that are associated with it are unexpected, don't come to the are not part of the ordinary expenses. Tell me why I'm wrong.
Well, I don't think that anybody can tell anybody in the court that there's not going to be
I'll give you the chance, right?
A normative judgment is made in this. Okay. And I think, if you may permit a digression to context from Miracle, that again, Miracle was a case, in our opinion, where this court said, we embrace the idea that you can be negligent in the adoption context. And then there's all these qualifiers. But the holding is, you can be negligent in the adoption context, but let's consider policy and see where we draw the line. I mean, the duty is clear, and then policy. And so this statute of limitations question comes on the backside of that argument, if you know what I mean. In other words, it's only the limitations of policy in this case that compelled that extraordinary or exceptional expenses language. Because flat out, if the court had said, we hold that there's a duty in this case in the context of the adoptive parent, adoption agency situation to act with care, but we're going to limit it just because of particular policy considerations, and here's one of the limitations. It has to be exceptional and extraordinary. And so you have to have a standard based on that. But remember, I think that the burden is almost shifted over to the LSS in this case because we have the situation where we think negligence and duty is clear under these circumstances. And so I think that, in this situation, their duty should be to show that ADHD, in the context of these folks, was somehow exceptional or extraordinary so as to trigger the running of the statute.
Sure.
And I don't think in the context it was. And I think that the circumstance is clear that a bipolar disorder is the type of thing, I mean, that says, oh gosh, this is a serious, this is going to lead to, and the record reflects, the need for extensive future medical care. And it wasn't. There isn't anything in the record, I think, that noted that ADHD had that consequence.
I'm wondering if we're not paying too much attention to Miracle. On page 32, the court says this is a very unique case. That here, adoption agency knew about a problem with the child, stated the potential, and then stated, well, your child is not going to have a greater likelihood of the disease, which the court, at least at that stage, took as a affirmative misrepresentation. The court then carefully says, quote, because of this uniqueness, we need not and do not address the question of whether adoption agencies have a duty to discover and disclose health information about children they place for adoption. Isn't that the issue here in this case, that the court didn't really discuss in America? Because here the agency had discovered and had informed in America, but misinformed. So why aren't we under the line in the case that this is not before us?
so we don't deal with it. Now, it seems to me you could argue that in this case, exactly what is before us is a duty to discover and disclose health information. And that the argument should be, and I think it's not implicit, could easily be inferred from your complaint, which is set forth in the appendix, that there's a duty to care, duty of care to the world, as our court uses, that therefore that includes the duty of care to the adoptive parent. And the duty of care is, especially if the parents say, I want a healthy child, some parents say, I don't necessarily want a healthy child. I want a child that has special problems because my mission is to take care of such a child. Here the parent says, I want a healthy child. So there's a duty of care to, on placement, to provide as best you can. Because life takes funny turns. You don't know what's going to happen, right, on birth of a child. So the duty of care to place a healthy child, which imposes a duty to investigate. Do you have to go to the ends of the world? No. You have to make reasonable investigations. That here, the argument is that there was negligence in making investigations. Therefore, there should be damages. Now, you're not asking that this adoption be reversed, are you?
No.
You're just asking for money damages, right?
Right.
Okay. So suppose I translate all of your complaints to that. How do you come out under the statute of limitations?
Well, clearly, and it's all nice to agree with the Chief Justice. I think that this is exactly the point. And it wasn't until 1994, clearly, that all the elements that were necessary to state that very claim, and I would back off because we don't even have to allege in this situation the duty to discover, because we, I think, have shown that the notes were out there. We didn't ask them, we're not asking them to look for it, just reveal it. So it's more a duty to disclose
they,
all these things.
Did they have the notes? My understanding is they didn't have the notes.
Well,
did they?
If you look at the record, Your Honor, the ECWS signed that very document. It was a pre-printed form, and ECWS signed it. And ECWS, Eastern Child Welfare Services, obviously, from even this limited record, is a closely affiliated agency in Korea.
Counsel, affiliated. Your opposing counsel takes exception.
I know he does.
And
in the record, you will see, if you look at the notes that they talk about from the doctor says that this orphanage, which in one place is referred to Jacob's Home, is actually the Eastern Child Welfare Services Orphanage in Chongqing. Okay? So, if that's not affiliation, this is ECWS, which is on pre-printed form with LSS, the defendant, which runs the very orphanage where this child was placed, where these notes were. So we really don't think that that's...
Notes, though, were not in the hands of Lutheran.
Well...
They were not physically in the hands.
Oh,
you think that they're accessible.
Certainly. And I think that back to your question on the statute, 1994, it wasn't in 1994 that there was the diagnosis of bipolar disorder, which led to the inquiry about those notes, which led to the doctor's opinion saying these notes relate back or relate to the bipolar diagnosis. So that is the time under the disclosure that we've discovered.
I'm going to have to interrupt you. Your time is up. You're relying on discovery, to put it short, right?
Yes.
All right. Mr. Black.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice. Honorable Justices, I'm going to follow up on what Mr. Grady started to speak about, and that is the duty. My intention is to argue the cross-appeal, because it's our position that Youth and Social Services did have a duty to act with reasonable care when providing information to the Nirgards. As pointed out, the Korean Agreement of Adoption was signed, and that stated in general that Youth and Social Services and Eastern Child Welfare Society provide as much information as possible about the health and social history of the child. We recognize the argument made by Lutheran Social Services that if that is considered to be a contract, under the case they cited, it may not be that in itself sufficient to assume the duty. It's our position that, aside from that, by their own actions, they also have assumed the duty to provide information. The record will reflect that at the time the Nirgarten were given the child, they were given three documents. The initial social history, which is in our appendix, the health history and physical examination, which is also in the appendix, and a child's pre-flight report. The child's pre-flight report with a translated document. And I point that out because the notes that we are speaking of, the orphanage notes, the documents also had to be translated. The initial social history made this statement. The child referred to this agency, meaning Eastern Child Welfare Society, December 26, 1986, and was removed to the Eastern Child Welfare Center in Pyeongtaek on January 5, 1987, to stay there until he departs from the USA. The orphanage notes start January 5, 1987. As pointed out by Mr. Brady, you have a document that both Lutheran Social Services and Eastern Child Welfare Society have mentioned.
Well, you mentioned that's different from signing. I understood, I can't find the document in the appendix right now. I thought it was an agreement between Lutheran Social Services and the adoptive parents, but I might be wrong.
I agree with you. It is in the last document on the response brief, and it is signed just by the adoptive mother and adoptive father.
Counsel, you're talking about a duty to disclose, and I know the opposing counsel indicated that once they undertook this, they did have this duty. But I'm looking at page 32 of the Miracle case, which was referred to by the chief. It also says that to avoid liability, agencies simply must refrain from making affirmative misrepresentations about a child's health. And he goes on to say, we do not hold that agencies have any duty to disclose health information. And isn't that troublesome under the fact that if they didn't know these notes, that they existed, and they had no duty, according to the case, to disclose health information. How would you differ with that?
I differ with that because I agree with your statement that the case states that, but about 10 lines down it says, having voluntarily assumed this duty, explain the letters of CSS language in the Greek, what we're saying is that even if you don't find a common law duty, they have assumed the duty by providing information. Once they provide the information, it's our position they should take every step they can to make sure it's accurate. We're not saying they have to go out and have a big full-blown investigation. We're not saying go out and have a big comprehensive evaluation. What we are saying is that in this case, you have Lutheran Social Services, the Eastern Child Welfare Society, which clearly have some type of a joint venture in adoptions. And
let me just pause again. Affiliation, joint ventures, of course, those are legal terms. Is there anything in the record to support a legal relationship between those two entities?
I take the position that the adoption agreement, pointing out both LSS and ECWF provide as much information as possible, signifies there's some type of arrangement. Plus, the initial social history, which is provided to the Nierengartens by LSS, is a Eastern Child Welfare Society form. I don't think there's any question that they have an arrangement.
Maybe a contractual event. I don't know. I mean, it could be that Eastern Child Welfare Agency deals with 10 different, you know, Lutheran social services, Catholic social services, Islam social services. So what's the unique affiliation joint venture that you have?
Well, I don't say it's unique. It's clear that they have some arrangement. And I don't know if the arrangement actually is relevant, because let's say that LSS is operating with John and Jane Doe's orphanage, and goes to John and Jane Doe's orphanage and says, we'll take Johnny and Susan. How burdensome is it to say, by the way, do you have any information about Johnny and Susan?
Well, let me say that I think it's very burdensome. I'm taking that position for the moment. You know, adoption is a good thing. And people who adopt do a great service, and children who get adopted find homes that they might not have otherwise found on permanent homes. And our society welcomes, supports, and encourages adoption. Do you agree with that?
I agree.
And indeed, the state goes out of its way to attempt to place children in adoptive homes. Now, why should we impose such a burden on agencies like Lutheran Social Services and impose significant money damages? There's going to be significant medical care for this child, right? Why should we do that when they're performing a service that our society encourages and fosters? Perhaps the court ought to be very cautious. I set up a cause of action, you know, my first question, which you welcome. Now I'm saying, you know, gee, I have second thoughts about that. Because of this need for the value of these social services. And we recognize that life is long, and that after birth, people have different experiences. Some are more fortunate going through life than others. And that's take and live it. None of us know what's going to happen to any of us or any of our children, biological or adoptive, right? So why should we impose the kind of liability and the kind of obligation that you want? Slow down adoption, cause greater expense. They're going to have to raise their fees if they charge any to adoptive parents, right?
Because they've already gone to the expense, if they have any, of giving information to give them. And so ask one question, do you have any other information? But I think also, I don't think a decision saying you have to make that simple request is going to cause a burden. I don't think it's going to wipe out adoption. We're not saying they are going to then guarantee the health of the child. Further than that. But I think it's going to that's going to instill more confidence in the whole process of adoption, where the parents know we are getting as much information as they can reasonably get to us.
Well, in this case, the orphanage happened to have it. And they also happened to have kept it. In the next case, the orphanage will have destroyed it. And but for the fact that the social services hadn't asked for it in a particular time, it's gone. So that's next. And in the next case, the orphanage turns this all over to the South Korean Human Services Agency, which is hard for all of us to find because we don't know the system or we don't know the language, and it's gone. So they don't ask the right question. And the social service and the state agency turned it over to a records management place. So it's somewhere buried in a computer. All of this is, not out of the realm of probability, right? So where does that stop?
Very simple. It stops at the agency, the child, or the pain from.
Well, that's because that makes you win in this case. The next case is going to be something else, and the lawyer is going to stand there at the podium and says, it stops here, Judge. What if the grandmother would have told one of the workers at Eastern Child Welfare Agency that the mother was an alcoholic? That wasn't written down. But the orphanage knew that. And maybe that might have implications in terms of fetal alcohol syndrome.
Again, where I'm drawing the line is within social services asking that agency, what information do you have?
Well, in essence, in my hypothetical, it's not written down, but the orphanage worker would have known that if the grandmother told
it. Again, what I'm saying is that the duty is to ask, what information do you have? Whatever they receive, then they've done the duty. They've done what they should do. Beyond that, I think it's a policy question to decide. Can you go beyond that?
Well, then there's your duty to ask, but then if from a public policy standpoint, later on, if you don't ask, order, you're better off not to ask or not to know anything, because is that
no, because again, in this point, they have assumed that duty.
So once they assume the duty, then that goes to the notice.
That's correct.
Okay, counsel, thank you very much. We're going to hear from Mr. Hayes on 5 minutes rebuttal, and then Mr. Black. Pardon me?
I didn't understand that he had rebuttal.
I announced that.
Okay. Thank you.
Full disclosure.
Let me go back to a couple of points on the statute of limitations, if I may, that were brought up. One thing I would like to address, Justice Crooks asked me earlier about the definition and how it might enhance it. It didn't mention that actually we already have an answer talking about children that have special needs. I'm not talking about that as a term of art, but if the child later has special needs, it seems to me that's another element that you could throw into your definition of extraordinary. Incidentally, in this case, they had talked about special needs using the term of art as a problem that this child had, and that would include ADHD. Their own materials would indicate that this child might have qualified as a special needs child, and that was their argument in their complaint, and it's contained in their documents. So they've used the very term that this court had used previously in the Miracle case. One other thing that I'd like to elaborate on with respect to this Caritas case in Minnesota. It's interesting to me that the Court of Appeals can cite Caritas in a positive fashion and ignore the fact that the damage in the Caritas case was none other than ADHD, and that was deemed to be apparently extraordinary damages. So they took from Caritas that one statement that was helpful and ignored the fact that Caritas itself talks about ADHD. Now, on the subject of disclosure, there is no duty to disclose, and we do not believe that you should impose it. As I indicated earlier in answering the question for Justice Bradley, there is a duty imposed through contract if there's a separate tort duty that exists, and there isn't one in this case. There isn't one here. There isn't one in any other case that we could find. In fact, the Gibbs v. Ernst case in Pennsylvania specifically rejected that. I would point out that the record does not show any relationship between Eastern Child Welfare Society and Lutheran Social Services. I would love to tell you exactly what that relationship is, but it is not of record, and I cannot tell you what that is. In terms of the agreement and the statement about possibility, in this case, Lutheran Social Services did all that it could do under the circumstances. It gave out every piece of information that it had. It made a good faith effort to comply. There were no red flags in any of the material that was furnished that would lead them to inquire further. And I think this court has made appropriate inquiry of Mr. Black on that subject and the slippery slope that you could be on when you extend a duty to investigate beyond where Lutheran Social Services has now gone. What happens if you...
But the line that you draw, counsel, seems to make it work the while of an adoption agency such as LFS to remain blissful in their ignorance.
Technically, under the Miracle case, that could be done. Are we suggesting that that be done? No. We think that that's bad social policy.
Well, shouldn't there be, so you admit then that there should be some affirmative duty on their part, on LFS's part, to get information?
No. There's a difference between what I think and what the legal duty is here today. My own feeling is that an agency should engage in getting a pediatrician to examine a child that's coming over. That was done in this case. The agency should supply a social history about the child. That was done in this case. There was a pre-flight report that was prepared. They didn't, after getting all that information, see anything that would say, we better check further in this case. There may be another problem.
So if you were writing this for us, how would you write, we hold that the duty of LFS or an adoption agency in a case such as this is colon.
It's a duty that's been fulfilled. I think that it's reasonable to say that if there has been disclosure of health information, okay, that you cannot misrepresent the information that you have disclosed. I think that the court's decision in Miracle, troubling as it was at the time for adoption agencies, is an appropriate statement of the law. I don't think I would add anything to that in terms of how far they should go. Now, there's at least one decision where there has been imposed a duty to disclose, but not a duty to investigate. There are several decisions that are said as a duty to disclose, but not to investigate.
But you said earlier, if I remember, that if you've taken on the duty to disclose health information, not only can't you affirmatively misrepresent, you cannot withhold information you have.
I don't think you should lie. I think that would be, say, the Caritas case where there was incest in their file. They didn't turn it over. I think it's okay for a court to say, you should have turned that information over. That's bad information that might have affected the decision of the adoption.
But